And we want to thank OCLC for help sponsoring our plenary panel today. We've got four. We have four very interesting speakers to speak on the topic of theory versus practice. And we will start off with some prepared remarks from each of our four speakers. I did ask them to prepare remarks relating to three questions. What do you feel is the most critical skill in reference staff? What are some innovative things that you are doing to improve your reference services or the education of future reference services staff? And what are your predictions for the future? So we will hear from each of our four panelists, and then we will open the floor for questions. When we do open the floor for questions, there is a mic in the center of the room. If you would please line up behind that if you do have a question for our speakers, and we will do questions after each of the four speakers has had a chance to share their remarks. So I'm not going to read their biography information. That is all in their programs. We want to make certain that they have plenty of time for their remarks here today. So I do want to invite up David Lankus, who will be our first speaker today.
The handing of the mic. I, too, will be going green during this presentation. Only hot air will be produced. Hi, all. It's great to see you all again. Talk a little bit. First of all, I'd like to, as is the want of every academic, take issue with the title of the presentation about the idea of theory versus practice, and that is to say that I think the only way this is going to work if it's theory and practice. There's a great statement that says that those who set sail without, setting sail without theory is setting sail without a map of where you're going, and setting sail with only theory is never leaving the shore. Something to that degree. But it comes down to the fact that I think we really strongly, desperately need theory within what we're teaching reference and in how we're practicing reference. If not, we will continue or become increasingly a set of cobbled together skills that come together into a set of best practices, but not knowing that they're really best. Simply knowing that they may be popular or efficient or cheap or who knows. And so I think it's really important that we set up going to look for what is it that we're trying to do and why are we doing reference. And as part of that process, I spent the year of my sabbatical, so I haven't taught anyone. It's been delightful. This is formal wear today. I didn't show up in my pajamas. That was last week. Looking at what are some of these underlying guiding theories that we can look at within the library field to talk about where we're going. And I think they have specific importance on reference because obviously that's where I started. And when I look at reference, what I see is at the heart of the library practice, I see a conversation. In fact, I once said that, you know, reference is an island of chaos in a sea of order, and that's a good thing. That, you know, as our cataloging friends look over at what we do and go, well, how do you put that on MARC record? You know, it's good that we can't capture that. But what are the aspects of conversation that we can bring into the reference activity we can bring throughout the library operation? So we call this whole big ball of wax participatory librarianship. If you go to my website, you can learn more about it. But I'm going to give you the end result here. The things that I think we need to remember is, first of all, that the user is in control of this process. And you go, of course the user's in control. They have the question. And yet, when we look at how we actually structure the reference interview in a face-to-face or in a virtual setting, how much of that is really under the user's control? How much of it, if you look at the desk, how much of it is do we assume that the user is going to have a question that's so burning and important, their question, that they're going to leave what they're doing, come to the desk and ask us a question? And exactly where were they in control of that process, other than the fact that they decided to submit to our organizational scheme? And you say, oh, Dave, so old, like so 2007. We're doing virtual reference now, and we can do it online. All right. So they come to your website, use your interface to ask their question, in which case you have the better tools and can kick them out at any time. At what part was the user in control of that process? So we need to really look at what do we mean when we have a user-centered system. Perhaps the idea of roving reference. I remember when roving reference was first discussed. And people said, well, what, do we have to wear like a name tag and a funny hat? And I said, you know, if it works. I said, really not so much, because when you're walking around, you can usually tell a user with a question. They're the ones going, help, help. Right? Look for that. Look for the frustration and things being thrown. That's where you go. The second thing we need to realize is that it's all about learning. And when we talk about learning, we say that the major mission, and I don't care if you're in a school library, an academic library, a public library, a special library, a law library, a divide library land, however you want, you're in the learning business. And the idea of what does it take to learn something is more than finding stuff. We know that the idea of showing someone a shelf of materials and saying they have learned is a crazy notion. So if we're in the learning business, why do we think that our job is to get someone to a resource and not to get someone to an answer? And so we have to really seriously take a look at what it is that we're in the job of, because if it's pointing to stuff, that, I think, is going to become a much less important task as making sense of the stuff in which we're directing people. We also have to realize that learning is a collaborative conversation, that when people learn, when they seek to know, they seek to engage in conversation. And people have had a good time with that term, but let me be real specific what I mean. A conversation is, first of all, a set of conversants. There are two or more people that are talking back and forth, but they can also be two in the same person, and people go, ooh, ah. But if you're all instructional learning, you've dealt with the concept of critical thinking or metacognition. Or if you woke up this morning and tried to decide should you wear the red shirt or the green shirt, who were you talking to? You were talking to yourself. Now, normally we don't like that in a library, but in this case, that's what quiet reading is someone talking to himself going, does this make sense? How does this relate to whatever I know? But increasingly, we bring more and more people into that conversation, and as was talked about in the keynote, with technology getting better, we can bring a wider and wider group of people into it. So once again, where in the definition of reference have we defined it as a one-on-one activity? It's not. And yet, because of resource allocations and because of worries about privacy in a physical setting, increasingly we divide and define reference as a one-to-one transaction. Well, why can't a reference transaction have 50 people in it? Why can't the person, since the user's in control, determine they want a librarian as part of that reference transaction, but they also want a content expert, and they also want their buddy, or their son, or their mother, whomever, to be part of that reference transaction and be able to be part of that conversation? The library serves as a facilitator of that conversation, and once again, I mentioned access is only one means of facilitation. If we're trying to help someone learn, we need to understand that facilitation involves access, knowledge, safety or policy, and motivation. So the idea of being able to say, here's the answer, here it's in these books here, is part one, and only one part. Because I can't read, that's not a helpful answer. So I need basic literacy instruction, or if it's an online conversation, I need basic computing instruction, or if it's in some area I don't understand, I need access to additional information. So access, one part. But only one part. The other is that knowledge. What do they need to know before they hit that resource? So we deal with instruction. We talk about, in academic settings, teaching people what scholarly communication is. But in a public setting, we need to talk about laws and sunshine and understand what's going on behind the scenes. The third component is that we provide a safe environment for them to do that. And in public, this often means physical safety. When we have children, we say, this is a safe environment, a haven away from all this other stuff to work and concentrate. But safety is also very much underlies our intellectual freedom statements, because what it means is you're safe to pursue an idea to its logical conclusion, not based on interference or worried about the perception of that. That's a safety concern. So we need to provide environments in reference that says it's safe to do this. And lastly, we need to worry about motivation, which is why are they doing this and how can we reward them for doing it? I mean, it's interesting. I think a lot of us look at the reward system that reference librarians have when we walk away from a successful transaction. You all have the story, right? It's the story. It's why it's the story that you keep in the back of your head when you have a rough day, you go back to it, and you learn about what is it that I changed the life with. Someone came in, and they needed information on shelters for battered housewives, and I found them that place, and I did good. That could be a story. The story can be, I had a student who was struggling, and I helped them through that assignment, and now they're a Rhodes Scholar. That can be the story. That story can be small. That person really needed something to read to get interested in reading, and I found the right book for them. But that's the story. That story is about conversation. It's about your motivation. The question is, what's theirs? Do they have to be there? Do they have to ask the question? And how can we reward our patrons for coming to us? We do a lot of things about marketing and letting them know we're here, but do we ever sort of say, thanks for coming in the door? I mean, maybe we need Walmart greeters, but, you know, whatever it is. How can we become a motivating factor in people's learning? True facilitation, however, means community shared ownership. How much would, a lot of public libraries do this. We want to get teens, and it's always teen boys. We want to get teen boys, so we threw a bunch of Nintendos in a room and life happened. Yay. So my question is, how many teens do you have on your board of directors? How many undergraduate students do you have attend your leadership meetings? How many groups and societies and historical associations do you say, that shelf is yours, take it and do with it as you please? How many times do we open up the library and say, this is your place, not just ours? We're responsible for the comfortable seating. You're responsible for the knowledge that happens here. And we need to often invest in tools of creation over collection of artifacts. We need to facilitate people in creating new knowledge, not simply consuming the knowledge we send at them. So really quickly, because I'm running out of time, this requires also a change in how we educate people. First of all, we need to recognize the shift of innovation from concentrating in the academy to distributed throughout practice and other industries. It used to be you go to library school to learn the best and greatest. Now you go to library school, and we're busy studying what's happening in industry and Google and Twitter and libraries such as these represented to say what's cool and what's happening. We're often synthesizing. That's a pretty dramatic shift for us. We need to model co-learning in the classroom. We need to, on the first day of your reference class, say, we as the professor know 50% of what you will learn this semester. You're in charge of us learning the other 50% together, and we need students not to yell about how much tuition they're paying to teach us. But anyway, we need to recognize and enhance that we are a participatory network within the schools, that we need to open our doors and actually talk to our colleagues. And one of the things I did this semester is I spent a lot of time going from Rhode Island and Long Island and Seattle and New York City visiting other library schools, because I think oftentimes it's only places like this that we say, oh, hi, Marie, it's good to see you again. By the way, what you've been doing for the past 10 years? We need to do that on a more regular basis. And this is the most important one, we need to include communication and political skills as part of our curriculum. The idea that part about where the innovation is centered, there's still many, many directors and head of personnel that assume it's still an academy, and so when they hire the new librarian, they assume they know more about the whole operation, particularly technology, than the people that hired them. And this is crazy. It puts that new hire in a really bad position, which is they become the young librarian. So anytime you come up with an innovative idea, let's go talk to Beth, Fred, John, whatever, the young librarian. They could be 98 years old and on the ventilator, but they're the young librarian. And they say, oh, we're going to do wikis. Great, let's bring in the young librarian. And so now we don't have to worry about it, and the person who has to worry about the innovation in the future is the person with the least experience, the least amount of organizational knowledge, the least amount of political capital to expend. Go. We need to teach those people how to be subversive change agents so that everyone coming out of our library school's job is to make us all obsolete and challenge us on a regular basis, and I include the faculty in that. And that's the last thing, which is we will quickly get into what are we supposed to be doing in library school, and I think we are nuts to think that 1 2-year experience somewhere in the beginning of your career equips you to be a librarian for the rest of your life. I think we need to understand that this model of graduate education is stressed at the best. That the problem is that practitioners get up and say, the people in the academy don't understand. The people in the academy stand up and say, you know what? We understand perfectly. We just don't have time. We agree with everything you're saying. It's just give us 12 years and we'll handle that. We need to talk about undergraduate degrees in librarianship. We need to talk about doctorates in librarianship for library directors. We need to talk about ongoing, regular, and required instruction for librarians in the field and supplemented and supported. I mean, you can't be a physical therapist in this country unless you go to classes every 2 years, but librarian deals with the most important thing and noble profession of our career. That's 1972. That's fine. So, that's what I have to say, and then I will shut up and I will sit down. Thank you very much.
Next we have Carla Stoffel, who will be speaking with us. And her handouts were included in your packet. There were two handouts. One looks like an organizational chart, and then one had some additional text information. And we will be displaying the organizational chart on the screen here.
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here, and thank the presenters. I really saw a lot of very interesting work going on, people thinking about issues, and I hope that I've even incorporated some of the things that I've learned already into my remarks. You know, everyone knows that library directors don't follow instructions very well, so it's kind of an occupational hazard. My most critical skill, I really worked on, could I identify one most critical skill? I thought for a while of having a one-sentence paragraph that maybe I could work it in that way, and then I finally gave up. And so when I think about critical skills for reference librarians, I think about a continual learner who's focused on the customer, not system-centered, which I learned in the traditional and hipster librarian session, our own operation-centered, with an excellent grounding in values and the philosophical framework of librarianship. It seems to me that that's, at a start, actually what we need in every librarian that works in a library. Secondly, I think we obviously need more people with more and more technology skills. The new in thing is now the social network. But the technology has to come from technology as a tool with this continual learning and kind of a flexible approach, because the technology is going to change. The technology you know today is not going to be the technology next year that you may need to be applying to the work that you do. But your work and your customers, and then the work you want to do for your customers should determine what technologies that you use. I think that we need, for reference, someone who understands reference writ large. And that, the Green definition in one of the sessions of reference from the 1800s, which includes instruction, getting customers to what they need physically, and enabling people as well as answering questions. And it seems to me we need people coming to our libraries who understand reference writ large, not reference as a desk or reference even as a virtual or chat environment where you're providing answers, but reference writ large to our community. We need people with the skill to understand that we have to take the library to the customer, not have libraries that require customers to know what they need and to come to us. And then we need people who are prepared to assess, not just count, but assess impact and monitor quality in our services, and constantly be seeking this continual change and improvement and knowing what difference that we make. Now, in terms of what are we doing at the University of Arizona, well, if you've heard of us, you've probably heard that we constantly restructured. So we did that again in this last year. We did this around a lot of things, but some concepts. Everywhere you are, the library. So it's based on the customer and where the customer is. And the library is virtual and physical learning environment. And then the idea that we would maximize the uses of our resources. So we would seek to get the most out of everything that we've got that we could. And we would engage in collaboration all over the place, on campus and off campus. And that a primary tenet of what we do is that we're going to stimulate learning and research, not wait for someone to know they need to learn or to do research. This requires that we think about embedding the library where the customer is. And so we restructured, and we restructured a number of things, but what we've ended up with is in our direct services, an undergraduate services team that's not responsible for reference desk service, but is responsible for training the staff that's going to be on the desk. That they're going to monitor service, they're going to assess quality, they do usability studies, They develop online instructional modules, online course modules, and most importantly, their most important thing they need to do in the next year or two is to integrate the library in the course management systems that we're using, eliminating a separate electronic reserves, building these systems to anticipate what the student in that course is going to need from the library, not just readings, learning modules. What kinds of, the student's got a term paper, third week of school, something that pops up and says, time to start your essay. Do you know how to start? Here's some learning materials. You don't wait for them to start. And that we do this anticipation. And that we help the faculty make the transition to course management systems. You'd think they were all using it, but frankly, they're not all. And some of them are using it very, very poorly. We need to experiment. One of the things I would hope that my undergraduate services librarians would be doing this next year is identifying faculty members in large undergraduate courses and working with them to develop online textbooks, not just electronic reserves, but using content that's available out on the web or that can be incorporated into an online textbook to help the campus deal with the campus textbook problem and costs, but also, again, this should be part of our job, reaching out to our community and anticipating what their problems are and coming to them with solutions, not waiting for them to come to us. My undergraduate services team is going to be responsible for outreach, both outreach to campus, various groups on campus, but outreach into the community. So we'll be remote. We'll be out there. And we've got a librarian who developed something called Lesson Link for and pulled on the campus all of the web pages that had content that was useful for K through 12 education, creating a system where this could be searched and that these would link to the standards of Arizona for the curriculum. And that's, again, reaching out, anticipating, and carrying the campus outreach out. The other big portion of our librarians are going to be in our research support services group. They're going to work with faculty and graduate students. They're going to identify campus information that needs to be organized, whether it needs to be organized centrally and in a main place, or it needs to be organized, for example, in science labs where they have papers and things that are in filing cabinets that they use, but they don't have organized and accessible. They'll do off-desk reference, and so we will move to try to create systems so that people who do come with a question, virtual and physically, will immediately be tracked to the person who's a specialist rather than the person who's at the desk struggling to answer those particular questions. These people will be soliciting resources for our institutional repository, developing tools. We've developed something called the Arizona Atlas, which is a tool that allows you to lay demographic and physical information together on a map of Arizona, creating Rangelands West, which is a database for agriculture, for ranchers, actually throughout the Southwest. And they'll be selecting commercial resources. Our access and information services team is actually serving at all of our desks, these are staff that are very well trained. They have competencies to do the desk work. We've measured the desk work that needs to be done, the kinds of questions. They also collect data at the desks so that they know we can continually monitor what's coming in. Are the uses of the desk, are they what we thought they were still, or is there more advanced training, or did we make a mistake and we need librarians back? But we studied for a year and a half and discovered 85% of the questions that came to any of our desks did not require a librarian to answer. And we were desperately short of librarians to do this other outreach work on campus that needs to be done. These people manage the buildings and manage the building-based services. so that we don't have librarians taking up their time doing things that they actually didn't go to library school to do. Future, that was an interesting exercise. In the future, I think you've heard a lot already of what the future might be, but it's less about helping people find information and more about helping people use that information. It's about creating services before the customer knows they need it. It's about creating information. Like in olden times, public libraries created community information databases, only they were in paper. We should be looking at the information that's not created commercially, that's not organized commercially, and that should be something that our reference librarians should be doing. We need to take the library to the customer. We need to be more involved and focused on assessment. We need to be heavily collaborative and not each one of us reinventing the wheel. And we may have to change the name from reference librarian in order to get people to think more broadly than what they currently do. Thank you.
Next will be Marie Radford, and we don't have any prepared presentation handouts or slides for this, so go ahead and just...
Marie, you can use mine if you need.
Okay, all right, so we'll start with a radical. So if you is in front of the thank you so much, all of you, for coming out. I don't know about all of you, but this has been one of the highlights of my career. I've already heard feedback from people that they've enjoyed this conference more than other conferences they've had recently, and we have to thank Dave Lankus for his virtual reference desk conferences, very similar to these where people were forced to be together for days on end, eating together, waiting in line together, and all those things where you build that kind of community. So just because I have the mic, I'm going to also briefly thank BCR for the organization. Justine is here. This has been going on for a year, as you all know. Brenda Bailey-Hainer. Wonderful volunteers and chairs, everybody who came out when I tapped them on the shoulder. A lot of you are here when I tapped you on the shoulder and said, come to Denver, come be with us. And obviously our distinguished speakers, our invited speakers, as well as all of you who submitted things to be presented, and obviously also our sponsors, many of which probably can't hear me because they're there hanging out at their booths, but they've been also amazing. And isn't the food good, too? Woo-hoo! Okay, that being said, all right, so we were asked to address these questions, and so the first thing is about the critical skill that we need for to be reference librarians, and I actually can't talk about a critical skill because I think it's a set of skills. It's really a set of skills, and one of the things Dave opened up by talking about the importance of theory, and as many of you know, I've been involved with Lynn Conaway of OCLC in a long 3-year grant from the IMLS studying chat reference. And one of the things that has been an outcome of this grant is a new theoretical framework for reference, for synchronous face-to-face chat reference, which is going to be unveiled very soon. I wanted to do it here, but I only have 5 minutes. But what that model talks about is the importance of having two major components, and any of you who have read any of my work know that this would be the relational, the interpersonal dimension, the face-to-face, the kind of building those relationships, whether it is actually face-to-face or in virtual realities, this idea of treating people well, of treating them as individuals, of being aware of what it is that's behind their question, of being emotionally intelligent, about treating them as human. human beings, not just as a, you know, questioner or whatever. And the second component, of course, is the content, the information, that we have to know what it is we're talking about. We have to have speciality. We have to be technologically competent. We have to know our subject areas. We have to be aware of general knowledge and what's going on in the world so that we can intelligently help users to formulate and figure out their information needs, as Dave was talking about, this idea of being very, very much a participatory environment. So obviously, we need our interpersonal skills, and we need our content, our information skills. The third thing, I was struggling with what to call this today, because it's such a huge area, but I just decided to call it for just today sort of the cognitive behavioral realm. And one of the things when I talk to employers and all of you who are hiring graduates of library school, one of the things you talk about is this being able to be light on our feet, to have agility, to be able to change what it is that we're doing, to move kind of freely, because things are changing so rapidly. And I have news for all of us. I mean, we all know this. The change is actually getting more rapid. It's these changes that have been coming along for us. It's actually been building very, very steeply now, so that from one day to the next, we have to be constantly adapting and figuring out what it is, where should our priorities be, and so forth. So this kind of fifth, to be able to move agilely in a fast-paced environment, to be change advocates. So not just to be dragged along by change, but actually to be the ones who are moving this change. And all of you here, I have been so inspired by what I've been hearing in all the panels about the incredible things, changes that are happening, where everybody's trying to figure out what is it that we should be doing and how should we be doing it and how are we going to deliver the best possible service to our users. And let me tell you, hats off to all of you who are on the front line. I haven't been on the front line since 1998 when I became, actually it was 2001 when I became acting dean of Pratt. I had to give up my adjunct reference work. My hats are off to you, because it's got to be the hardest job in the whole world these days, being on the front line in the library. I get choked up. But so these behavioral things, curiosity, the wish to be developing, honing our skills, you know? And, you know, Dave was saying, well, you know, you have to be, Dave, I'd love to disagree with you, so I will, that these other professions, that they have to go out and be certified. We are learning, we are lifelong learners every minute of our working day. We embody lifelong learning. Which brings me to another point. Time management. And so Carl was talking a little bit about these roles, the professional versus the pre-professional versus the power professional versus the staff roles, right? This is a major area for us, a really something we have to come to grips with, okay? Don't we want to do it all? Don't we want to do it now? Don't we want to go after what's new and exciting?
Yes.
Thank you. Do we want to give up anything?
No.
Bill Pardue, where is he, Bill? How are you, Bill? Back in the back. Good thing you came in. We would have been embarrassed if you weren't here. Bill Pardue said today, and I quote, "We're not ready to sunset anything." That's why we're all going to early grades. Because we want to do it all. We want to do it now. We want to be offering the best possible services. We want to be meeting our users. I've been doing a lot of research about millennial generation. We need to be out there in all of these new, exciting, wonderful 2.0 applications, because really that's where they are. And if we don't go there, we're not going to be meeting the needs of those users. We do, however, obviously have all of our other traditional users and their traditional needs to meet. So one of the things that I mentioned this in the context of time management is that it's our responsibility to kind of figure out the professional role these days. Where are we spending our time, and where should we be spending our time? And all of you need to spend time every week, I would suggest Monday, if you work Monday through Friday, the beginning of whatever your work week is, to think about that week, how you're going to be spending your time, and what it is that your priorities are, and also what you can delegate to other people. And I was doing a lot of consulting for Brooklyn Public Library, and I met with a lot of volunteer students and part-timers, and every single one of them told me the same thing without prompting from me. They could do more if they were asked. They want to do more. They want to do different things. If they're reading books, shelving books all day, some of them have talents that we don't even know about. One young person who was in high school said he was a computer genius, and no one had ever asked him. And if he went near a computer, the librarian would shoot him away. He was at a branch of Brooklyn Public Library. And he said no one ever asked him what his talents were. No one ever asked him what he wanted to do when he went to college and so forth. He said he could run rings around any of the technological problems that he would shoot away from. So this is a responsibility that we have, because we are, as professionals, we are educated. Carla said we got MLSs for a reason. Many of us, some of you may not have the MLS degree, but if you've been working in libraries for a long time, we have developed these skills, these expertise. excuse me. As far as innovations are concerned, at Rutgers, one of the things that I've been moving more and more toward, and one of the things that Dave also mentioned, is this idea of service learning. We can no longer just be in the classroom with our students. We have our students currently in the Internet Public Library answering real reference questions for Internet Public Library. We're going to be exploring, Beth Kakowski's here, call her out. We're exploring with Q&A and Jay how to get those students. We were inspired by some of the presentations here where students are doing chat reference already. We are also involving our students very heavily in consulting projects. I assign students to pair up with a manager of library services and do a consulting project where they do research, looking, not just saying we have a problem, what should we do, let's form a task force and talk about it, what is in the literature, what is the research, what are other people doing, and then to prepare an executive summary that they give to the consultant, the person they're consulting for, an executive summary bulleted with short-term and long-term recommendations. And one of the things I've been hearing today, the last 2 days of this conference, is we're spending too much time in writing long reports that nobody reads. So forget about long reports. You write an executive summary, and then you tell people longer reports are available. Guess what? No one's ever going to ask you for it. And if they do, slap your executive summary on some long report you have in your drawer, staple it, and hand it to them. But believe me, they'll never come back. They'll never say this is a wrong report. Never. From our, I was like, this is like totally ridiculous. Anyway, okay, future. Thank you. Future. Look, I've been saying this for a while. Is this not the most exciting time to be a reference librarian? Yes. I've been on the front line, for 20 years. I'm older than I look. 20 years. 20 years I was on the front line. I never saw this excitement. This conference, I hope all of you enjoyed and went to all the sessions. Wow, what you people are doing is unbelievable. I have been so inspired. The future is right here, boy. Just take a look. Just take a look at what you all are doing. So more of the same. It's going to be coming at us fastest and furious. And again, this is where our time management comes in and figuring out what skills do we need to upgrade. Right? Some of the presentations were so great here because they were so practical. So this morning I went to the one on using the search engines, the Google customized search engines. Right? I can do that. I just learned today how to do that. It's going up on my webpage as soon as I get time. Shut up. Okay, so now, let me just talk about two things I'm on the soapbox about right now. What is this merging? How many of you have so enjoyed, if you're public librarians, talking to the academic librarians and vice versa here at this conference? Have we learned a lot from one another? Don't we see how this is merging? And I think some of the things that are driving that is distance learning, that now aren't the distance learners coming to the public library, and we're seeing also that more people are coming in to the academic libraries with more like public library type questions. So we're seeing this real merging. Okay, the technological innovation is driving things to more portable devices. One of the future items I see as very, very, very important is the cell phone. And I'm the only one saying this, but please, if you're not already publicizing your phone number, get it on your website. Get it really, put it in the gold triangle, you know, on the upper left-hand side, put it in the biggest numbers you can put so that they won't be below the fold. And tell everybody that you meet that the library has a phone. And when you do instruction to academic librarians, tell the students you have a phone and put your number, have them open up their phones and put in their buddy list the phone reference number. Because let me tell you, this is the technology of the next few years. And with the iPhones and everything else, and we're going to be getting our websites onto the phones, et cetera, et cetera. This is what I feel is going to be really heavy. The last thing, point that I want to make is about this idea of collaboration, which both of the previous speakers had already mentioned. I want to see the end of the Lone Ranger librarian. Look around. We're all here. We're all in it together. When we need help, we don't have to be the only person at the reference desk answering the question anymore. We're IMing, we're Twittering, we're beeping, we're whatever it is we're doing, right? We're all connected. And so this idea that you're alone at the desk, when I was a school librarian, I was in a frickin' basement. I didn't have a phone, I didn't have a fax, I didn't have a Xerox machine. If I wanted to make a phone call, I had to run three flights up and beg the secretary for me to let her leave the phone to call the local public library, right? I was the Lone Ranger then, and it was very scary. I was also very young. I didn't realize how bad it was. Me and those eighth graders. But now, you're on the desk. And I've seen this in the transcripts that we have done analysis with people in the middle of chat, calling another library to ask them to answer them, putting it right in the chat to the user. How beautiful is that? And also then telling the people in chat, come on, give me a call. Or saying, are you in the building? We know between 25 and 30% of our users on chat are probably in the building. Okay, so then they go, hi, you know, like, are you near a library? I'm over here, right? So this idea that we're the Lone Rangers or that we're that distant, I don't even like the idea of the remote user anymore. I say the online user. Okay? So I think, you know, the future, I think the future is really rosy. I don't think that we're going to be out of business anytime soon. As a matter of fact, with this increasing complexity of our information environment, they need us now more than they ever did, and we also need one another more than we ever did before. Thank you.
I think we're going to move the sugar.
Shut up.
All right, we're all invigorated now. Those post-lunch blues, those are all gone away. We've got one final speaker with us, Jamie LaRue. And again, you will find the handout displayed overhead as well as within your packet. So, Jamie.
She was more excited in 10 minutes than I've been in my whole life. A couple of quick observations. The first one is, given the title of this section, I thought I should give you one of my favorite quotes. In theory, there's no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. Second, do I have anybody here from Douglas County Libraries? Hi, guys. You get to raise your hand, Justine. You're not alumna. Okay. Hi, guys. Okay, we were asked to talk about three different things. The first one is the most critical skill, and as you can see, I'm not going to go through all these individual things, but here's what I've learned. There is really only one skill that matters, and that is the skill of communication. The story that I'll give you about this is about touch. I was working as a graduate assistant at the University of Illinois when they did a kind of a groundbreaking study, and the idea was half of us were told, when you provide service, just provide the usual service. And the other half were told, find some way to touch the patron. Not fondle. Just touch. Likes very touch. And so we did that. So as you're checking things out, handing them the books, we'd reach over and just very, very briefly lay a finger on the forearm. Anything else? And then they were stopped as they were left, and they were asked, what did you think of the service that you received today? And the ones that didn't get touched said, I asked for a book and they gave me a book. And the ones that got touched said, the service here is superb. They didn't know that they'd been touched. I believe that the single most important thing that we do in reference service is the acknowledgement of another human being in front of us. It is eye contact. It is finding some way to listen to what they're asking for, even if we don't have an answer for them. The heart of communication is the ability to be in the same space with another human being. That's the most important thing we look for, and that is the essential service for the 21st century. Touch. Okay, second thing is innovation and education. Downtown Development Committee, I'll come back to. But I want to talk about something that I believe is the most groundbreaking service in public library reference today, and that's economic gardening. The theory is the fastest growing piece of our economy today is the small office home office. Most of them start at the library, and most of them do it completely under the radar. They don't come and identify themselves as somebody who is trying to start a business, but those are the questions that they're asking for. We can help them. We do help them. We could be a lot better at it. The second thing that happens is after you've been in a business for a while, and we have somebody in Douglas County who's producing some sort of genetic bioengineering in his basement, which sounds really dangerous to me. I keep being afraid that he's going to flush his toilet someday. So what we need to do is move this guy out of the basement and onto Main Street. And so that's called economic gardening, developing the gazelle, identifying the person that is now ready to take the next leap and go from the family business in the basement to a business that employs 5 or 6 people and rents space on Main Street. People that are doing good work in this, one includes Rochelle Logan at Douglas County Libraries and Christine Hamilton Pinnell, who actually parlayed this idea of the consulting reference librarian for business into an economic development engine for the city of Littleton. Very, very smart. We need to be paying attention to this one. One of them, I'm sure you probably heard Lori talk about this, and Hutch. They're involved in the contact center, and this kind of goes back to the rise of the telephone. Whereas we've learned that voice over IP means that we can start to aggregate all of our phone lines, much easier to do a centralized switchboard, much easier to start gathering a lot of information about what's happening around the district. And I will point this out. For a long time in our libraries, our staffing patterns have been driven by where the telephones are. Very interesting. Start counting this in your own agencies. As we removed the telephones, we found that we were freeing up all of these people. And by concentrating everything in a central switchboard kind of thing, we were able to do the kind of statistics that were hard to gather otherwise. What is the percentage of phone calls that requires a reference degree? Very similar to what we heard from Arizona. About 16 to 20%. That's it. Now, the 16 to 20% are really hard questions. And we need reference librarians for that. But that gave us, for the first time, some interesting information about what the actual level of activity was. The next thing is about the education. Is we started something called the Leadership Journey. And this is basically succession planning. Maybe recession planning, too. The first year is to say it's know thyself. We're trying to teach the real skills of leadership are, again, all about communication. But it's also about self-knowledge, about self-awareness. And so that's what year one is about. We've identified 10 people within our organization to say, we're putting a couple of $1,000s behind each one of you to say, let's talk about this. Let's make sure that you're ready to take over. Year two is all about playing well with others, by which I mean project management, formal collaboration, the ability to do committee work with each other and get things done. Okay? I think that's a useful thing for all of us to be working on, too, identifying the computer geniuses hanging around the computers and putting them to work. We have a lot of talent, let's use it. Okay, predictions. I'm probably the only one to get done in under 5 minutes. I'm shooting for it. The first one is the notion that it really begins with what I think is the next big wave of automation coming through our libraries, and that is the destruction of the circulation desk. And our library begins with RFID, it then moves into self-check systems that with RFID are much, much easier to use than the barcode. We went to 90% on the day we opened with it, 90% self-check. And then we got to playing around with how many touches do we actually have when an item returns to us. Incidentally, circulation, such an old-fashioned term, still 86% of our business. CERC is what people come to public libraries for. And I'll say just to my academic colleagues who uniformly tell me that circulation is in decline in the academic libraries, ladies and gentlemen, what are you doing to change that? I have heard that there are people who have gotten all the way through their undergraduate career without having read a book. Shame. There are things we can do to promote the printed word. I think that would be a good idea. But anyhow, end of rant. Back to the circulation department is dead. We started counting that we were handling each item 6-7 times as it returned to us. We have now gone to an automated materials handling. We now handle the book once, put it back on the shelf. That has liberated some of the finest minds in our organizations. They are no longer building in intense carpal tunnel syndrome problems. They are free to roam from the desk. We gave them training. We put them out there as paraprofessionals, and it made our reference librarians very nervous. They said, I thought that was my job. And we said, now that you have the time, we need you to go find the questions that no one is remembering to bring to us. We need you to go into the community. And I guess I will jump right to that. Except that, one more thing. The reintegration of departments, much like the smaller libraries that have always operated as teams, when you become a larger, more complex organization, you tend to separate. You specialize. And we have these silos within our organizations of people who do not talk to each other. So one of the things we've tried to figure out through this disintegration of the fortress, the castle of the circulation desk, the fortress and the moats around our reference desks, is to say maybe there is, in truth, a concierge who greets you at the front door and makes eye contact with you and moves you seamlessly to somebody at a reference area who can hand you around to the person who has the greatest expertise. A seamless experience. Or someone once pointed out to me, walk into an Apple store one time. This is exactly what happens. Someone greets you, they move you around. You want to talk about that? We have an expert. Here he is. Move people around seamlessly. This means that the new expectation for a reference librarian is leadership. They have to be the leader of a team of paraprofessionals. That means we will be growing and hiring for leadership skills. The ability to communicate, the ability to manage a work group. Okay, now to talk about the big one, and that's the librarian as community asset. Colby came into my office one day, brand new reference librarian. She said, I'm worried. I think that we're doing away with reference. I think that, you know, is my career obsolete? And I said, I'm so glad that you're here because I have just discovered that a group of business people in Parker, Colorado are trying to solve some problems, and they're stuck. They need a reference librarian. So I take Colby to the meeting and I say, business people, this is Colby. I'm assigning her to you as a reference librarian. And they said, isn't that nice? And they all but patted her on the head. Oh, we have a mascot. Then Colby identified the people that really had some questions. And she said, what do we do now? And I said, well, you and the manager take these people out and do in-depth reference interview with them. And the manager came back and she said, you know what, there are four questions they're really trying to solve. They can't fix what's wrong with downtown until they find out the answers to these questions. So the manager parceled the questions out to the reference librarians. This is not the you'll find it over there kind of answer. This is in-depth reference. This is something that requires the MLS. And then at the end, you can't say to a bunch of business people, we found a bunch of stuff, here you go. You have to write an executive summary. But writing the executive summary isn't enough. You have to present the information. You have to package and present the information. And so now the reference librarian is expected not only to do the in-depth reference interview, not only to do the research, not only to write the executive summary, but to present that information to people in a way that they get it. Today, when the Downtown Development Committee meets, they look around and they say, we can't start yet. Colby's not here. That, ladies and gentlemen, demonstrates the intense value of a reference librarian in the community. Another example, we've been talking about OCLC from awareness to funding. We're pretty good about building use. We're not so good about building support. When I went last year to the Downtown Development Committee to say we're about to go back to the voters for funding, they said, oh, Jamie, we've been talking about this. We have dedicated $40,000 to your campaign. Are there any questions? That's the future of reference. Thank you.
Well, we've had four excellent speakers. If you would join me again in thanking all four of them for their remarks. And I think they've offered some very intriguing comments. We do have a microphone in the middle of the room available for anyone to ask any questions of our panelists here. I do invite you to come to the microphone in the middle of the room, and I'm horrified. I can see no one standing up. We've had Marie cheerleading us into action. We had David putting us in front of a maze that looks like it has no end. There must be questions for this panel.
I got yelled at and told to shut up, so I need to respond to
Marie. All right.
I have my sugar withdrawn.
All right, fair enough. Here's your damn sugar. All right. So the point was just the idea that they're all excellent lifelong learners, and I acknowledge that. The question is, though, how much time do you have devoted to learning your profession, learning your skills and advancement, and how many do you have to pray to get enough money to come to Colorado every fifth year? That was my point. It's not that you guys can't learn. Of course you can. And not that you shouldn't learn. That's not the point. The point, though, is that we need to make education prioritized, structured, supported, understood, and appreciated a core value within reference, that so that our lifelong learners can also be devoted to advancing all of us and not just what I learned from that last reference question. So we agree on this.
I totally agree.
Could you please state your name and where you're from?
Rusty Gaspard, Louisiana State University. It's a great conference. I'm looking forward to next year. Increasingly, college students are being referred to as customers. Number one, do you agree with this label? And number two, how does this affect or redefine customer service at the reference desk in an academic setting?
Well, I think that if you want to only define customers in terms of economic transactions, it probably is a problem. But in fact, when we call people users, we have a whole group out there that never uses and that we don't put much effort into. And customer service is, in fact, I think, a very positive concept to think about in terms of our libraries, because these are people who in the past we treated as if they didn't have any other option, but today they have a lot of other options. They may not be using them appropriately, but they really do have other options. And we need to take that into account and think about our services in that way and treat people as we would want to be treated and reach out to the people who are not using us for whatever reason, and think about them and their needs and how we develop them as people who use the libraries.
One quick comment. When I was at ALA Anaheim, Joan Fry Williams said, you know, they were having this problem of do we call them patrons, do we call them users, because there's only two types of users, those who use drugs and those who use computers, and they're both addicted. And she went out and asked the people in the building that weren't librarians, what do you want to be called? And this was a public setting. They overwhelmingly said member. And I really love the phrase member because it implies not an us and them relationship, but a co-ownership of this activity that's going on.
Just a quick kind of to build on that, too. There is at present a profound loss of meaning about the public sector. And we've been pushed for a long time to say we're running our businesses, we're running our organizations like a business. There is something, of course, important about understanding customer service, good customer service. But I think the use of language like member is one of the ways we again begin to advocate for the value of the public sector.
I just want to chime in here. I think we can get really taken down a wrong path, I think, if we're really focused on this too much. I mean, I always talk about service excellence. And I think whether we call our users patrons or users or members or clients or customers, I think that the really important thing is that we're focusing on service and excellence. And so I really don't think that that's as important as what we call them, although I know this is a hot button issue for a lot of people, but I think that it just kind of takes us in a direction that we don't really need to go in. And what we need to do is figure out, as this panel is going to talk about, what is it that our users or members or whatever, what is it that we can do to meet their needs, and how is it that we can figure out their points of view rather than what it is that we think they need and then go about trying to meet those needs, which are really us talking among ourselves about what we think is good for them. And just like, just as a good response to one comment that Jamie made about, you know, they haven't read a book, shame on them. They have different reading habits. They have different communication habits. A lot of the younger people, they have different information-seeking habits. And perhaps they haven't been into a building to check out a book, but they are reading, and some research that's starting to come out now is that these kids are reading more and writing more, much more, than a lot of we boomers were. But they're not reading the classic novel. You know, they're not reading the things that we used to kind of think. Remember when I was in high school, like when I walked in and blew the dust off of Moby Dick. Nobody was reading that. And the things that they wanted to read were the more youthful novels. I think we are responding with a lot of the more graphic novels and other items that the young people want to read. But we have to kind of be careful when we are making these value judgments about their information-seeking behavior. So.
Well, and I would say, to then, yes, my circulation of books is going down. And we are, in order to maximize the great investment we have in print, we're now actually going to the stacks and getting articles and scanning them and sending them to the desktop. We're going to the stacks and paging books like libraries have done forever. So we are trying to promote those resources. But quite frankly, I had 8 million hits on my commercial materials, in the online materials, in the last year. I never had 8 million of anything done, maybe public libraries. And in addition, I had over 4 million hits on my non-commercial materials. That's 12 million uses. Even if you say, well, they might have hit it, they made a mistake, they came in by mistake, they checked out books by mistake, too. So, you can't say everyone that checked out, they read. So, you know,
but they did highlight it.
Right.
Yes,
I think you're agreeing with me. I think you're just agreeing with me that they're what they're doing, download. So you're looking at your downloads and hits, sometimes more than physical source.
Right. Yes, please go ahead.
Paul Adesian, University of Alaska Fairbanks, although I also moved my our borough public library. My question is directed especially towards Mr. LaRue, although many of you are interested in what you have to say. When I was being trained after getting my degree and starting on the reference desk, we were instructed, I should say my first job was at the public library, and I continue to move right there. We were instructed not to give any legal advice or medical advice, or business advice. And as exciting as the consulting librarian idea is to me, and the idea of a librarian will not only print off a stack of articles, but will make an executive summary, something of use to people, I wonder where you draw the line between research and interpretation, or research and advice giving.
I think it comes down to practice and expertise. What librarians need to understand about business people is they don't just want a list of resources. They don't just want a bibliography. They want less information. They want focused information. Surely we should have the critical skills to evaluate the resources on the basis of which one is the most relevant to that information need. I would also point out that I think a lot of us are not giving a lot of medical information by pushing people to specific medical databases to say, here's the stuff here. I think we need to be bold. Doesn't seem to me that it advances the aims of our profession to say we don't want to offer information that's weighted. I think we should.
John Berry wrote a really interesting editorial on this called Risking Relevant Research a number of years ago. He was talking about this. I think that there is a line between saying, you know, that I'm prescribing that you have this drug to our drug users, but to be saying, here's the information to help you make that decision. When I was talking about executive summaries, I was talking about internal reports, not executive summaries to users, but Jamie was talking a little bit more about packaging. So I know you may want to...
I guess one other thing that I'll point out here, in fact, Aspen is back there. Aspen has a wonderful, which is another Douglas County employee, has done a wonderful presentation that's online about how to do effective graphics and PR. I think, again, do we ever want to get good at this stuff? Do we want to be real information professionals? Then maybe what that means is we have to learn how to package the information in such a way that it does get used, that it can be used. I think that's the next level of expectation for skills in our profession.
This could be a quick question. I'm Jenna Hartel. I'm a newly appointed assistant professor at the University of Toronto. I'll be teaching reference for the first time this fall. Can each of you recommend a book or an article that should be required reading for students of reference? Thank you.
Everything's edited by Dave Lang.
My favorite reference article to this day remains Bob Taylor, 1968, on question negotiation. I mean, it's a good place to start. Bob Taylor fans, all right.
she approached me. She went away already. Approach me afterwards. I'll give you my syllabus because there's lots of readings that I recommend. I don't think there's any one single book or I would like, aside from what written by Dave Lankus, that I would really recommend. But I don't know if Jamie and Carla have a recommendation.
No, I've written quite a lot.
Shameless self-promotion. We're good at it.
Just Google us. You'll find them all.
Yes, please go ahead.
I'm Luann Freund, and I'm also an assistant professor teaching introductory reference courses. My question has to do with the message that I've gotten from this conference is that the core skills are management, leadership, communication, creativity, flexibility. And if we teach all that, as you said, Dave, there's no room to teach classification and online searching and how databases are structured and what reference sources are out there. So obviously some of this has to be learned on the job or in continuing education. And I'm not even trained to teach people how to be managers or communicators. So how do we cope with that in education?
Just to touch on something that was mentioned earlier, I think we need to go to an undergraduate degree for librarianship and a master's degree for leadership.
I would agree that I think it's time to move back and think about an undergraduate degree so that we're not trying to force everything into a year or two. And therefore, just touching on things lightly, because that's about all we want to do. I do think, though, that the profession has to take some responsibility and not rail at the library schools about what we get or don't get in the beginning reference library. We do have a responsibility to support and promote continual learning, which I talked about. I started out with, I want you to graduate people who are steeped in the values and the philosophical framework that librarianship has in its approach to information. And everything else is kind of gravy to me because I can teach them most of the other stuff. My staff will probably complain because when they hire beginning reference librarians, they want somebody who's going to come in and do the job day one. But I do think as a profession we do have to look at that. But what's really important for the future is, one, recruiting really good people who are good communicators, who are flexible people, who understand the current our libraries. And, you know, when I talk to library school classes, you know, I have people who say, gee, maybe this isn't the profession for me. I wanted something rather more quiet. I think in getting good people in and then having them really understand what librarianship is about, that there has to be a covenant between libraries and our schools that there are things that we will do. We can offer internships, probably do. You could be, not you personally, but library schools could be a little more flexible about these field experiences or internships and what you're requiring. If you really need students to develop these skills, we can provide these, and I'm offering more and more graduate assistantships to people from the library school to work in the library. So we can do that. We can work together on this. I think it's time for us all to work together on this stuff instead of pointing fingers at one another. But, you know, probably the long-term solution is really thinking about an undergraduate degree with the graduate degree really being management leadership and, you know, solving some of the bigger problems in libraries, not the day one job.
I'd actually really like to just disagree with one point. I don't think that the undergraduate degree in librarianship is an answer at all. I think that any... all of you clap. See me.
And all you clap before.
Okay. All right, now. Because one of the, I mean, if you have a general, good general basis, hopefully that you've been to the undergraduate degree. When we do admissions, we really look heavily to see that people have had a really good grounding and at least, you know, a little bit of a general education in addition to some subject speciality. But I just want to back up one second and say that if anybody heard me say that it's only about communication, I want to just restate that I had that as a three-pronged thing. I said it was about interpersonal communication, the content, which is knowing your sources, your systems, that is imperative that we can't just be nice and smile at people. We have to know what we're talking about. And if anybody ever hears me saying that, please do not, I have never said that. And then the third thing are these other, what I'm calling cognitive behavioral. I think Jamie was talking about the same kind of thing, being able to, and I think we were all talking about this, that we have to be able to be sensitive and emotionally intelligent and all the rest. However, one of the things that I think that's happened in library school, and I really applaud what Carla just said about working together, because I have been told many times that, oh, library schools are not listening and so forth. I say, well, you tell us. And when I go to conferences, I frequently ask practitioners to give us some. And a lot of times, I just think people like to complain. And I have to tell you, when I was an elementary school librarian, we would all go, I don't know what happens in the high school, because they forget all their library schools the minute they go to high school. And then when I was a high school librarian, they said, I don't know what they're doing in the elementary school, because the minute they get to high school, they don't know anything about the library. And when you get to college, I don't know what they're doing in elementary and high school, because when they get to high school, they're not anything. And it's the same kind of thing. It's like, whoa, you know. So one of the things that I think we need to realize is that our basic reference course fits in to a program in the curriculum. And one of the really critical things are the advanced reference courses, like we're now calling it advanced online searching, whatever you want to call it, but business, humanities, social sciences, and that we do have advanced courses, but of course you can't have it all in that class. But I will also recommend one book to the person who was also asking, and the two people who are teaching, Conducting the Reference Interview by Catherine Ross, which is Neil Schumann publication, which goes into a lot of these communication areas, even if you don't have that background.
Shelley Walchak, Colorado Library Consortium. And Marie, I just want to tell you, I'm also a New Jerseyite, so it's so good to hear you act.
Forget about it.
One of the important things that I've been hearing throughout this conference is a discussion on celebrating our differences. This kind of came up in a session this morning and in several private discussions throughout the conference. And to me, this relates to the very important topics of ethics and civil discourse. I think that this, like other things we've discussed throughout this conference, is especially relevant in this rather fractured time that we're living in. And I think that the library can play kind of a mentoring role in our communities in regards to this. And I was just interested in comments from the panel on this topic.
You know, when I give my speech about the idea that libraries, the core of librarianship is conversations, facilitating conversations, one of the first questions I get back, there's two. One is, which conversations? You know, there's millions of them. Which one do we pay attention to? And I say things like, you have a collection development policy. Clearly, you've already made some decisions. But the second one I often get is, well, if knowledge is created through conversation, what if the two people talking are just idiots? And it's this idea that you know, that somehow there's this pristine truth out there, and we as librarians have been trained specifically to find it. And we come and create shaman-like powers, and the glow of reality shines through our eyes to our patrons, and they're informed. And this idea that we do a lot of research and credibility. The two most important factors for the person uses when they determine if something's credible, and it's done in less than a second, is it pretty? And do I agree with it already? This idea that you're going to take someone who watches Fox News and tell them that Barack Obama has the way to go, we know that doesn't work. And so this idea that we can teach polite discourse is an interesting one. So one, we have to start where they are, not where we are, and hope that they will follow our example. The second part of that is, the word facilitation does not mean wallflower and disappearing and invisible. That Colby, as mentioned, wasn't really good because no one noticed that she was there. Part of why she was there is because she was a visible resource. They knew that they could go to her, and they saw the effectiveness of her work. Librarians, we're in a reference interview. This concept that somehow a reference interview could be unbiased, we have to give that up right away. The minute you either reach for the keyboard or reach for a book, you've shown a bias. The minute that you've decided to use English, you've shown a bias. The minute that you're typing slowly or fastly in a virtual reference thing, you're prompting a bias. We have to have biases. They're heuristics. It's how we go through life without having to debate, should I take the next step or not? The point is that as librarians, we expose them and make them explicit whenever possible. That we say, look, there are multiple sides to this. I'm going to do my best to identify the multiple sides. I know you're going to pick one. And if you then come back to me and say, give me more on point A, it's going to be almost fruitless for me going, no, but look at point B and C too. We've done our due diligence. Now the question becomes, do we give it up and solve the question that we were asked? Or do we force them to get information they don't want? But what it comes back to is what everyone said here is, these are communication skills, not genre knowledge. The idea that you could quickly manipulate a rotating index does not teach you how to deal with someone over there who has the wrong answer from your perspective and what to do about it. Political skills. What do we do when we say business is important? We're going to prioritize economic development conversations over public sphere questions, whatever. Those decisions we make every day as reference librarians and as libraries, and ultimately those become down to communication skills, understanding where the community is, and understanding the community norms and functioning within them, but being an active agent of the community, not simply a servant to the community and not apart from it.
Just to build on that a little bit, I think there's very much a staff transformation that's happening in the public library world. We took those cert clerks and made them paraprofessionals. That put upward pressure on the reference librarians. They move out into the community. And that puts upward pressure on branch managers who say, I thought that was my job. And you say, no, now your job is to serve on the board of the Chamber of Commerce. And then that puts upward pressure on the directors who says, I thought that was my job. And you say, no, now your job is to help set the agenda for the whole community with your community partners. And that's how it happens, is that our expectations keep putting upward pressure on everybody who works at the library to get deeper and deeper into the community, more and more knowledgeable about what their actual needs are, and seeing themselves as a community asset. not someone who just enforces the rules or is a nice, polite, and quiet place to be, but someone who actually brings something to the table. And by the other question I didn't answer, what to read about the reference, is A Place at the Table by Kathleen Dillard Payne and McCook.
And I would say that what Jamie just said about the public library is absolutely true about the university library, and is some of the thinking behind our restructuring, where we are sending our research support services people out into the campus community, pressure for them to be looking at what the needs are and having dialogue in that community and developing responses to that, which then moves their team leaders up to another level. And I've got them dealing with deans now on a dean level, and instead of that being my job. My job is to work at the vice president level and at the university level, trying to get us into the picture as being seen as we are supporting university goals and objectives, and that we are seen as not having our own competing environment in the library where we're competing with everybody else and we have our own goals. But our goals are to help you, this university, achieve your goals for students and for the community.
I'm Lori Van Court. I'm from Douglas County Libraries. I have a correction, and that's going to segue into a question. The correction is that my colleague and Hutch and I no longer work for the Contact Center, and therein lies the tale. We were four reference librarians in that Contact Center, and as Jamie has told us, there were 16% to 20% of the questions were not reference questions. For dyed-in-the-wool reference librarians, when there's not enough reference work to do, we make up our own. We're very much like border collies. If we don't have sheep, we'll turn something else into sheep. Our supervisor wasn't thrilled with having us, frankly, because we didn't have enough to do. That was a piece of it. The other piece of it was the paraprose that came in, and that are still, by and large, in our parapro positions, are legacy people who came from CERC processing. And I have faith, because I've been with this district for a very long time in a number of different roles, I have faith that this is all going to shake out. But my question is about transition, because it is agony. It is agony to be a reference librarian where you're either not appreciated or you hear people who don't have your experience or your education answering questions wrong, and you're tied up with making a library card or collecting fines, so you can't jump in and fix it. And so how do we as professionals handle this transition? It's good in the end. We know it's good in the end. But the process, I think, may be killing some people that we don't want to lose.
A couple of things. First, it takes a village to raise a library director. Thank you for the correction. And the second one is, this is, again, the difference between theory and practice, isn't it? You know, if we can say we need, you know, the point here is to say we are promoting reference librarians. We are taking people that were answering some questions behind a desk that were visible to something like 50% of our community. And we're giving them the additional training and skill to get out into the community, to change the community, to transform it. So the individual problem at that desk, now you have those previous CERC clerks, now paraprofessionals, there's lots of training. There are some people who won't do well at that and leave, and that's okay. And then it's all about building a new team culture that takes a lot of trial, a lot of hit and miss, to finally work out the pattern to hand that question across seamlessly. But let's also be honest about this. There have always been a lot of unsatisfying reference transactions that happen with fully professional staff. This is not a new question.
Could I just point out one quick thing? We just had a reference staff in a public forum correct a director. This is brilliant. I was talking to some of the urban library council who says, as a profession, we tend to beat the testosterone out of people. The true leadership skill is creating an environment where this can happen, which is trust, and it gives them the ability to go out and innovate and try and risk because they know that this is possible. It keeps him honest, but it also gives him the reliance that he knows they have an opinion he can turn back to them and that they don't speak. And so this notion of what the real skill is for the directors and the administrators and the managers out there, how can you create an environment where the reference staff are willing to get up in an open public meeting and say, all right, fine, but let's try this, and really have an honest discussion at all levels of the library to answer those questions about what is the future, what are the core skills, what's happening.
And I just want to say, too, like my heart breaks that you said that you're collecting slides and doing library cards instead of doing the reference card. My heart, that just breaks my heart. Because I would say, if you're standing there next to someone and you see that they're answering a reference question wrong, this would goes right into this empowerment thing that you say, you know, excuse me, you know, listen, let me tell you some take that I have on this and see what you think of what I have to say, which doesn't demean what they're doing, because also we are going to need their help, because we can't do it all, as I was saying earlier. We want to do it all, but we can't do it all. And those are the kinds of decisions that I'm talking about. And that, but you also, I applaud you for, but it doesn't sound like you left because you wanted to, though. Did you leave because you wanted to?
Well, no, I should be clear. We didn't leave the library district.
You just left that,
with the department. Because Jamie and our department head are very tolerant and very creative, they created a new job position for us. I tell everybody I meet, we're the luckiest two people in library land.
Yeah.
We have fabulous jobs.
Because one of the things also, like I say to my students, and then they come in and they'll tell me that they're not appreciated as reference librarians. They're not like this idea of empowerment to say, you know, if you can contribute something here, speak up, right? But if you don't feel that you have that in your environment, then what I tell my students and what I tell everyone here is leave. Because that's not going to, and especially sometimes we feel that we're totally unempowered, and that our if what we feel is our profession, if our professional duty or our service is taken away from us and given to someone else who's not qualified, then I would not stay in that position. But I'm happy to hear that. But
I also think that what is happening is a pendulum swing, and we've gone from way over here to way over here, and that it's going to come into the middle. But we haven't gotten to that skills-based routing at a unified desk or a central contact center. We haven't gotten to, well, probably the CERC folks are best at doing CERC work, and the reference curriculum ought to be available for those kinds of things. Instead, we've gone into kind of this group growth where everybody does everything. And I don't think it's working real well, especially for the reference librarians who are feeling pretty bad. But it's going to get better. We know it is. It always has.
I agree that this is very much the time of transition. Lots of things to work through. A couple of comments about that. One of them is, I was talking to someone about this in Good to Great. They talk about two grocery stores that start doing experiments, and they find that there's something that works. And one of those grocery store chains adopted the things that worked and is still with us. One of those grocery chains rejected those things, and they are no longer with us. For way too long, reference librarians and any professional librarians, we do things to gain status with each other. We need to learn to earn status with our communities, with our funders, with the people that support us. And that's what this is about, is trying to take the real best practices. I have often seen the recently liberated paraprofessional who is as thrilled with his job as she seems to be with hers. And you know what? Sometimes he does the better job answering the reference question because it's his passion. So this is ultimately, I think, about the attempt to promote every single person who works in the library to the next level up.
Well, I don't like being condescended to, A. And B, I'm not talking about without proper training as well. I mean, obviously, there would have to be a lot of training. But I don't believe that we can usurp our responsibility that way, by doing the fine collecting, the shelf reading, some of the other unprofessional tasks that we are doing. That's what I was talking about. And I don't see anything wrong with proper training and supervision and having someone else do reference. But if we are then not doing the reference that we've been trained to because we're doing other things, that's what I was talking about.
Okay. We have one patient gentleman. We'll take one last question for the panel.
I'm Caleb Tucker Raymond. I'm at Oklahoma County Library in Portland, Oregon. I think maybe you've really all kind of answered this question already, so I appreciate that. And I hope you'll just say whatever you want. As long as you don't answer not this conference. But so I think about what you're talking about circulation statistics and Jamie, you were saying about 86% of the difference. I think we'll reference, story times kind of 10% and references is going to be down there for people in the four. So I think at any library, reference is a really small part of what the library does. It's a real line. We're the ones getting the funny news from the conference. That's crazy. But central in my mind is that books are really an artifact of maybe the artifact of the 20th century, the most important artifact in the 19th and 20th century. And that's no longer true. I think we've lost that. People in this room, maybe not so much, but everyone outside of this room, the vast majority of them, I think, the cell phone really is taking over already. So the question is this, now what?
Now what, panel?
So now what is figure it out. This is what I was going to do in the rah-rah ending, but I'll figure another thing out for that. Then now what is not this panel's to answer. It's this room's to answer. The now what of, we start with a keynote that talks about the idea of what role are we in, and basically gives up fine. Find and search, not our problem anymore. Do we agree with that? Don't we agree with that? Touch. Touch is the center of what we do, and I'm not fondling, though. There's a cartoon waiting to be had. But this notion of what is the value that we bring to it is determined by us. That somehow, if you're sitting and waiting for someone to tell you how do we define reference, how do we enact reference, and what are the core skills, I put that out as a talking point. I want everyone here to define that, and I want our libraries to be living organizations that we're having an ongoing conversation about how did we make our community, our world, better today. That's the answer.
I think that's exactly right. I would say there's a facilitation technique called appreciative inquiry, and it's based on this premise. You begin with what you're really good at, and then you apply the things that you're really good at to the next level of problems. OCLC found in its research that we have the most successful branding in libraries of any institution in the entire history of civilization. Say library and people say book, okay? So what's next is more, better, deeper. We take everything that we learned from the manipulation of that, from the discussion of that, the primacy of the idea, the significance of literacy, and we work that deeper into our communities and grow the value of our libraries as a contributor to the community.
I think I agree with that. Also, let's step back again. If we define reference so narrowly that it has become answering questions at a desk, which is something, quite frankly, in academic libraries, there was no reference desk on a consistent basis until the 60s. If we define it that narrowly, then I think that we are in real trouble, because we're saying people have to come to the library or they have to approach us in order to get the benefit of what we can provide, whether it's virtually or they physically have to come in. If we're wedded to that as a definition of reference, then I don't have a lot of enthusiasm for what our libraries would be like 10 years from now. But I have a lot of enthusiasm for what our libraries are going to be like, given that you take a broad approach to what is reference, and that we are out with the goal of benefiting our communities, whether it's a public library, a school library, or an academic library, that we're helping the community achieve its goals by the knowledge and skills and the values and the philosophical framework that we bring to community information problems. that's basically what we are about. So we've got to get away from a very narrow definition of reference and a very narrow definition of what libraries do.
I totally agree. One other thing that I'd like to tout right now is more intergenerational cooperation with librarians. One of the things that I also wanted to say, one of the things I think that's next, is that we have to learn more that someone made reference earlier to the hipster versus the traditional, which was by a PhD student, Hannah Kwan, at Rutgers University. And we have this bifurcation in our staff that I'm seeing and I've been hearing about maybe one of our most critical problems in our profession right now, because we see that the younger, hipper, maybe newer to the profession, maybe not younger is not the right word, although a lot of times the millennials who have grown up with different information, different communication seeking behaviors, more savvy with 2.0 and so forth, which we are coming to, which they come to as more digital natives than we do as digital immigrants, that we need to have more learning, that they need to learn from the more experienced librarians, and I'd like to see more intergenerational teams. So one of my answer to the question, what's next, is more sharing across generations in our staff. I'd like to see that more. And I also agree with Dave and Carla, and that we're seeing a lot of change coming at us, and we do need to be able to be light on our feet and cope with a lot of these changes. But our basic values, our basic service values, are going to remain the same as I see it.
All right. Well, please join me in thanking our panel for this. And this concludes our plenary session. There is break available in the hallways. The afternoon sessions will start at 3:30 in the breakout rooms. And please do join Marie and David for their closing remarks this afternoon after the afternoon sessions.